I'd like to start by asking you when it was that you knew you wanted to write. Do you remember a particular moment, how old you were?
When I could first put pen to paper, I was writing. I was probably 5 years old. I put out a family newspaper when I was about eight, something like that. It was like a regular newspaper. My father was a newspaper, so that's how I learned the trade, as it were. But I always added little cartoons or comic strips or whatever to the newspaper to make it more, quote, realistic, more like a newspaper. And so I was making up stuff really from early on. And I kept on doing that. By the time I was in high school, I was writing little mock fairy tales and stuff like that. And went into the Navy after college. In college, I took a one writing course. There weren't much available at that time in the 50s. And I took one, and it was okay. I went through it, and it led me astray for a while. I began thinking about what magazine I might publish a story and that kind of thing. But I had a great experience in the Navy, and then the month after, I ended up spending 6 months in at a base in Bremerhaven with not much to do, and got I mean, it's what I was assigned to do. I did every day, but I had a lot of reading time. So I just checked out the local library, and that's when I began I hadn't had that in college, that real interested, focused reading period. And it was all, you know, everything from Cervantes and Ovid on up to current things that were I was most interested in, namely Samuel Beckett and L'Absurdists. So when I got out of the Navy, then I spent a month up in Canada before I went started going to work, before I went to the University of Chicago as a student. I spent a month just focused on, well, who am I as a writer? And I got much more serious then about what I was doing. Beckett kind of taught me to think of writing like a vocation, not a profession or a way that you make money or that you get famous and so on, but think of it like almost like a priestly vocation. So I did that. I took with me up there to this island in Canada. I took all of Beckett's work then available. It was up to about the unnameable. I read that up there. And all the absurdist playwrights, but also I took the Bible along. I decided I wanted to read it from cover to cover like a novel, see what it had that was good and what was not. And the not outweighed the good much by a lot, but I did find a couple of things I kind of liked, and I did get a kind of fascination for Genesis, which is like a folktale compendium. So I had that kind of double read of reading the Bible straight through, plus a certain amount of history stuff around it that I'd taken with me. And then the contemporary fiction that was then contemporary, people like Beckett and to some extent Burroughs, and I also read at that time, I was reading Miller and the writers from the end of the 30s or end of the 40s. And but avoiding mostly the popular writing, the writing that was kind of Mailer-esque, you might say. He had a certain talent, but a lot of the people following him did not. And I kind of avoided that whole genre of writing. The book of Mailer's that I liked the most was Advertisements for Myself, which is a kind of compendium of his failed starts, you know, starts that didn't go anywhere. He published them all under that rubric, and some of it was more interesting than anything he was working on. And so that was the circumstances in 1957, 58. And from that moment on, I wrote my first really interesting stories at that time. And then got into all the work that led to the Brunus book and to the Brooke Songs and Descants.
At what point would you say you knew you were going to be a writer rather than you wanted to be?
I think that month in Canada, I mean, up to that moment, I was like any other wannabe writer thinking about fame and fortune and so on. And I just dispensed with all that and got into the business of writing. And I felt right away, no, this is going to be fine. It's going to be a lifetime. And it has been. So that's what this event this week is kind of focused on, is how we got here. So I avoided everything through the years that would be a distraction from it. And I for example, have never taken tenure, never accepted tenure anywhere, and I've never carried on with any kind of a job past the opportunity to resign from it. And just stayed from focused on the writing alone is the main thing. Spent a lot of time in Europe, where we lived like paupers, but had a good life, and I wrote a lot. It was overseas. I used to be able to say, everything I had written had been written after midnight and out of the country, and that was true.
In Canada, were you by yourself that whole time?
No, the first time I went up there, I was by myself. That month I spent was kind of the conversion, you might say. But then a year or so later, I went up there with my wife and very young daughter. She was just learning to walk. On that occasion, I had a two-week break from the job I had, and I was a playboy, and they gave me 14 days off, so I tried to get started writing 14 different stories. The idea was to get started in a story, not worrying about finishing it, because I had plenty of time, little dribs and drabs of time after work or at night when I could kind of redo something, rewrite something. But I didn't have time to get really thinking about new stuff. So I sat down and wrote exactly 14 new stories. And one of them almost wrote itself at the time. And I've got a book of short fictions collected now out. And the oldest story in there is from 1962. And it's one I wrote up at Rainy Lake, up at this island, on that second excursion when I was writing a story a day. It's one of the stories that I wrote on that occasion. There are others in my books that were eventually developed into stories, like The Magic Poker, for example. But that one just came to me entirely as it was, just a one-off thing. And I liked it, and Evergreen Review liked it. They published it. That was my kind of first serious publication.
Now, it's interesting you say your appreciation of the Norman Mailer that did not succeed outweighed that that did. Was that were you already thinking in that direction, that where you wanted to go was not down that conventional road?
Yeah, that's the whole point. That I think that was the point of that month, or the reading in Germany that then translated itself into a real program by way of Beckett, that I saw what a writer might be. And from that moment on, I didn't think in any other way, as that's been my whole career since the 50s. So there was never a temptation, actually, to follow these other guys or to do something that was popular. It just never occurred to me. The only thing I had to do was work out what I was doing as well as I could. And what I was doing was it had to do with stories, and it had to do with the kind of stories that are in prick songs. And I knew that, and eventually I would have to write things, longer things like it. At the time, I had got myself embroiled in fiction that I wanted to write, but it was not in the style that I was interested in. It was basically a realistic novel. It was the origin of the Brunists, and I had gone to New York looking for a job in editorial or something. And the editors were not really looking for anybody to come in to be an editor. But they were interested in what I was writing. I had published by then a story with Saul Bellow's Noble Savage. It was a coal mining story. And whenever I'd start to describe to them my ambitions, they would say, well, that's all very interesting, but are you ready working on anything a little more like the story you published in Saul Bellow's magazine, Noble Savage? And so I began making up a story, saying, yeah, well, I'm working on something. And so I kind of created an invented novel. And then it became interesting to me because it had to do with a religious cult that was very fundamentalist and very chileastic. So I had wanted to confront that side of things anyhow, and that book idea gave me an opening. So I got really unhappily involved in it. At one point, I got so angry with myself for backing off the projects I'd set for myself to do that book that I just gave up on it and put it in a box and threw it under the bed. At the time, I was reading all kinds of things, but one of the things I was reading was Pynchon's V, and I found it really fascinating, and it was a wonderful kind of imaginative work to recreate something that had never been there, but it seemed like it was. But I also found him very funny, and I realized that the worst thing about the boxed-up manuscript under the bed was I'd lost my sense of humor. I was so determined to finish that damn thing that I had become kind of determined in the wrong way to get through. So I suddenly just tore it all up, started over thinking about that fact that the book had to reflect a sense of humor as well as sense of commitment, and it allowed me then to finish the work. And then I kept working on that idea, invented a sequel to it right then. But I was by this time really deep into the Pricksong's modes, the Gerald's Party, which I'd written in the mid-80s, was a kind of book-length Pricksong. That's how I thought of it. And that's where my real fascination was. And only years passed, and we get the Bush regime, and we get evangelicals pouring out of the swamp, and I decided I had to finish that sequel that I'd been thinking about for so long. And that's how The Brunest Day of Wrath came about. But it also has elements that are not realistic, but it has a basic realism that was not something I was enthusiastic about. So I was glad when it was over, but it took almost a decade of my life to finish it, to get through that thing.
Is there anything you've written that would stand alone as something you think this is exactly what I wanted to do?
Well, there are two books that fall in that category. They're not the most popular books I've written. The most popular book I've written is the Universal Baseball Association, J. Henry Waugh, proprietor. But the two books that were where I was really focused on what I was doing were Gerald's Party. And then when I finished, in Gerald's Party, I just tried to think of all the things that I wanted, all the ideas that I'd had in Pricksong's and all the ideas I'd had since, formal ideas about how to construct something, how to make a tale work. And I just piled them all in on Gerald. And it worked well, but when I was done, there was still a lot of stuff left over. So the next major project I undertook was John's Wife. Like Gerald's Party, it's got a proper name in the genitive plus a noun and for title. And so John's Wife became the slightly improved version of what Gerald's Party was. It's a very different story. But the idea of accumulating all of these narrative ideas and then making them work somehow in a context with each other was more fully realized in John's Wife than it had been in Gerald's Party.
Now, in the literary festival, there's the panel discussion. postmodernism, what was it, what's next? And you're often described as a postmodernist. Is that something you would claim to? And if so, what does it mean?
Well, it's not something, basically. We've ridiculed the term my entire lifetime. It's been a word of ridicule. But on the other hand, I could see that one of the panelists will be Sam Cole, who writes for the journal here, who wrote a pretty good book on three of the writers who are attending. But his focus is on quantum physics and how that defines postmodernism, as it's called, as separated from modernism. The modernism is essentially a stream of consciousness idea that you have, in a way, a psychological reason for everything that happens. And the new work, the postmodernist work, doesn't have that, doesn't use that at all. It instead uses construction of a story as a kind of basic notion, which comes out of different attitudes we've come to have about how time works, about how the universe works, about time, space, motion, all of those things. And when I was at Chicago, I got involved in all that. And I studied with a philosopher there and was pretty taken by that movement of the late 20s, 30s of the physicists. So what Cole was writing about made some sense to me, that it was like a way of seeing that there is, in fact, something specific about postmodernists that's different from the modernists. I don't believe in any of these titles, really, and you can't really say who's a modernist and who isn't, much less who's a postmodernist and who isn't. But there was a aura, there was something in the air that changed in terms of our intellectual engagement. And that could be called postmodernism. I tend to prefer something like metafiction, which was Bill Gass's term. And I think metafiction describes more what we're up to, which is the meta being the main thing, and the fiction being the noun that we've been playing with. And so metafiction has as one of its characteristics, as any change of fashion in thinking and in writing, it has a tendency to be self-reflective, because it's trying to figure out what it's doing as it's doing it. So it's a period when you're trying to get an understanding of why it is you want to do something differently from all those terrific writers from the past. And that self-reflective thing, where you start talking about where the fiction becomes part of the narrative, as it were, the writing of the fiction or the composing of it. So that quality that it has is, which is temporary, because the notion of being self-reflective was true of Cervantes' time too, very much so. And that was another period of time when we were making fundamental intellectual changes from the past. So, and Don Quixote helped create that. And so there was a focus then on kind of metafictional constructs that came back into power now when we were trying to escape Aristotelianism, as it were. So I think there is a way to see. I'm hoping that, this is going to be somewhat contentious, I'm sure, the whole episode. I'm challenging the committee with an essay I wrote. In the 90s, I wrote The End of Books, which you may have heard of, and it was a discussion of the way electronic world was going to sweep away the print world. And I think it's largely happening. And then I got asked so there's a collection of essays mostly by writers, which are on experimental literature. What is experimental literature? It's new stuff, and so the writers are young. And they're all throwing about ideas that make writing experimental. And they asked me to do a foreword, and I tried, but I didn't get around to it. And so then the guy who was putting it all together, editor of it, asked me to do an afterword. he's coming also, so it'll be interesting to see how he reacts to, he'll be on the panel, Jeffrey DeLeo. And what he was trying to do with experimental literature, he was proposing to me to do something that would like sum up what they're up to, and what I instead wrote was a thing called The End of Literature, which follows on the end of books. And it's a real challenge to the committee. I mean, everybody sitting there is going to have to deal with this idea. And it proposes an historical evolution that creates literature, and then it comes to an end. And that we may be witnessing the end of it. So that's what I was...
So is this your answer to that question, what's next?
Yes, exactly. So that title got kind of, it's okay as a title, but it's probably, I disappointed the woman who's directing it only wanted it to be about my writing, and she's being very ferocious about that. So it'll be up to the other panelists to find a way out from under that and to talk about these issues, which is more interesting to me.
So this whole festival, I was talking to Rick Moody earlier today about and he made it kind of sound like you've done festivals over the years here many times, and his description of it almost sounded to me like if this were the Oscars, this would be your lifetime achievement award. Do you see it at all like that? Have you become more reflective on your entire career now, and what do you think?
Well, metafictionists, you know, reflect from the start. So I think I was being reflective when I was starting up in 62, in the early 60s.
But well, you just have more to reflect on now.
Yeah, that's true. But I think what the reflections now suggest is that I went ahead and did what I wanted to do. And that was very determined to have that happen. And my stubbornness and getting that done is part of the story.